Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with longtime Southern journalist Curtis Wilkie about his new book, When Evil Lived in Laurel, The White Knights and the Murder of Vernon Dahmer. Curtis Wilkie is one of the great Southern journalists covering events all over the South, but particularly in his home state of Mississippi. After a distinguished career at the Boston Globe, he began teaching at the University of Mississippi and retired in 2020 after teaching there for 18 years. He's the author of 6 books, The Road to Camelot, The Fall of the House of Zeus, Arkansas Mischief, and Dixie, A Personal Odyssey Through the Events That Shaped the Modern South. Today, we're talking about his new book, When Evil Lived in Laurel, The White Knights and the Murder of Vernon Dahmer. Curtis Wilkie, I am so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Susan, thanks. Nice to talk to you again.
What a page-turner this book is. It's just, it keeps the reader turning those pages and wondering, even if you know what's going to happen, you're just shocked beyond belief at so many things. So talk about deciding to revisit this story at greater length.
The story had an interesting genesis for me. I was approached by members of the family of Tom Landrum, who is basically the protagonist of the book. He was a white guy who lived in Jones County, Mississippi, and he had been approached when he was 33 years old back in 1965 by a friend of his who happened to be the local FBI agent to see if he'd be willing to join the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan in order to report on them to the FBI. And Tom had later been identified, much to his distress, as a Klansman himself, and Tom and his family wanted that rectified somehow. So they had a collection of several hundred pages of his journals that he kept for a 4-year period, and they were his daily and sometimes weekly reports to the FBI about the Klan's activities, vivid descriptions of their meetings, their arguments, their paranoia at times, and their threats for violence, which in many cases they carried out. In Mississippi, during that period where the Klan was effectively terrorizing the state, they were the ones who were responsible for the infamous murders in Neshoba County, and their target in this book was a civil rights activist operating in Hattiesburg named Vernon Dahmer, who was head of the NAACP there. So it was just a story I was automatically interested in. I had some history in covering some of these events, and I just snapped up their offer to use Tom's journals, which formed basic raw material for the book.
Well, in so many ways, you're setting the record straight for him, and you show us what that kind of work was like. It's so nail-biting and terrifying, and the fear of being caught all the time and bringing danger to his family as well.
It was not something I would have undertaken had I been asked to do that in the 60s, because this was basically a murderous band of characters. They were, even though they were outstanding citizens in Jones County, one of them was named Man of the Year in Marl. Right. Another one was the circuit clerk who was in charge of voting in the county. These were really some pretty dangerous and vicious people.
Well, one of the things you do so well in this book is give us a portrait of the members of the Klan group, and it's a complex portrait. I mean, you refer to them, and Tom refers to some of them as broken men, and yet they were ruthlessly clever in picking juries, getting people to run for political office, and the language they used is just horrifying. So talk about the decisions you had to make as a writer when you're talking about something like that.
Well, I used some pretty coarse language throughout because I felt I had to capture realistically what kind of came out of their mouths. And having been a young journalist in Mississippi in the 1960s, I knew how these people talked, and I reconstructed or created some of the dialogue, but much of the dialogue in the book came from either Tom's journals or from a treasure trove of FBI material that I located at the University of Southern Mississippi Library between what the Lanfrum family gave me and what was available at the Southern Mississippi Library. I had just extraordinary material to draw from. So I chose to be as rough in the language as I was. That's what you have to do to effectively portray these people.
It always chilled me when they'd refer to a planned murder as a project, a group project. Like, let us require our members to do one project a month. I mean, that's something that just stops you in your tracks.
Yeah, they were racist, and they were pretty vicious. The one thing I discovered in this, and didn't realize for all of the terror that they carried out, and some unfortunately very successful missions to kill people or to burn down houses, was how basically stupid they were and incompetent in many ways. And so many instances they were broken people who might have joined the Klan to have a club to belong to,
mm-hmm.
to try to find a place where they could have camaraderie with fellow travelers, and they screwed up a lot of things. They could have been even worse than they were.
But as you say, they wanted a place to hang out. Two of them owned cafes, but they were incompetent. A getaway car that's undrivable, dropping guns all over the place. I mean, if it weren't so horrible, it would be laughable.
It would have, because this all happened in the raid on the Damer home, where they succeeded in killing Vernon Damer. They burned his house and burned his business down, and his lungs were so badly seared during the time he was fighting them off with his own gun to give his family a chance to escape the burning house. During all that excitement, one of the raiders, who loved cowboy movies, and he had styled himself a quick-draw holster for his pistol, and he proceeded to drop the pistol and left it behind. They came in two cars. There were eight of them. And as they're both pulling away to flee after setting fire to both the house and the business, a character in one car thought the other car was actually the police, and shot out the tires of one of the getaway cars. So eight of these characters had to pile into one car and go limping back to Laurel, which was about 25 miles away, cursing each other and screaming. And then one of them speaks up about halfway back, saying, "We need to go back. I dropped my pistol back there." So you can imagine the reaction of these people. Obviously, they didn't go back to get it, but they left behind two key pieces of evidence, the drop pistol and the car they had to abandon. So, all these characters were tracked down within a couple of months and arrested and indicted. Not all of them were convicted, but, it was their own foolish operation that unfortunately, cost a very important figure's life.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Curtis Wilkie about his new book, When Evil Lived in Laurel, The White Knights and the Murder of Vernon Dahmer. So talk a little bit about Vernon Dahmer and the sorts of things he was doing. He was really an accomplished, beloved person, a real family man.
He was. He had a nice big family. At the time of his death, he had four sons who were all serving in the military. His wife, Ellie, was a school teacher. He had two smaller children who were living at home, and he was a very prominent black leader in Forest County, Mississippi, and was head of the NAACP in Hattiesburg. And he was basically a well-known figure among civil rights people in South Mississippi during that time. I think he's a really an unsung hero in that not enough people today know who he was, and not enough people really knew who he was and what he stood for when he was killed. He was one of the most active people in the state during that period in encouraging his fellow black citizens to be able to register to vote. The Justice Department, civil rights lawyers worked closely with him during that period in the 60s before the passage of the Voting Rights Act and then afterwards. So he defied the segregationist politicians who were running the state and certainly running his home region, and fearlessly defied them. He defied the Klan, who repeatedly threatened to do away with him, and eventually they did. But he was a church-going man, very popular and very well thought of, and yet again another example of a prominent and very good black leader who was murdered standing up for his own people in the 1960s in Mississippi.
Now, the truly evil character behind that murder is Sam Bowers, the Imperial Wizard of the White Knights, which were a particularly violent group. And he was obsessed with Vernon Dahmer, and he is somebody you actually came face to face with during the trial.
Yeah, I was, luckily enough for me, when I was still writing for the Boston Globe and living in New Orleans, I covered the final trial of Sam Bowers in 1998. And this was, if I do my math right, 32 years after Vernon Dahmer was killed. It took them that long to finally convict him. He had several trials that ended in hung juries, and on occasion it was probably because the Klan had put a ringer on the jury list to prove their connections with county officials. Sam Bowers was a very strange character. He ran a jukebox and pinball machine business in Laurel called Sambo Amusement Company. Oh. And he lived in a little kind of monkish-like in a hut in Laurel. Recruited a lot of his members from the Masonite Company, which is a major factory in Laurel, to join up with him. He was the grandson of a congressman from Mississippi. And he had all sorts of illusions of grandeur, and he thought he was a great philosopher. He had something he called the Christian militancy, this sort of pseudo-religion that he espoused. And he was the leader. He was the imperial wizard of the White Knights, and truly an evil man. There is, in the state archives in Jackson, I located this, and you know it's public. Anybody could look at it. There were a series of four interviews that he gave to an archivist in the 80s. It's quite chilling that, you know, the several hundred pages of hours talking about himself. And he had, by that time, done some prison time for his role in the Neshoba County murders. In none of the operations where people were killed did he go himself. He dispatched people. So he was not at the scene of the murders, but he was the one who orchestrated them. And it was so often done in the name of this perverted Christianity that he called it.
Oh. Now, of course, the town and the landscape come alive in this book so much. You have this recurring image of men walking off into the forest to talk. They're paranoid about being bugged, and, you know, they're worried about hiding guns and things like that. Have you been back to Laurel?
Oh, yeah, I've been down there a good bit. Tom Landrum was still living when I undertook the project, so I got to know Tom and interviewed him quite a few times before his death, right before Christmas in 2019. And, you know, there are not many people still living who were around at that time or had a, you know, major role in all of this. There was another man that I already knew and came to know much better, and he was kind of a sounding board for me. He's a retired federal judge named Charles Pickering, who had the county prosecutor back in the 60s, and Judge Pickering was very helpful to me in reliving that time, because he had done his best to put these guys away when they were still operating. And he was a friend of Tom Landrum's, and you know, both of them, you know, lived under threats, you know, of death, and you know, to burn down their homes. The Klan didn't know Tom Landrum was informing on them, but they certainly knew that Judge Pickering was trying to have them arrested and sent to prison. So, yeah, I spent time there, and you know, and I had had covered the Bowers trial when he was finally convicted. So, and I grew up in South Mississippi myself, so I you know, felt like I was, you know, quite comfortable in dealing with the setting.
Welcome back. My guest is Curtis Wilkie, author of When Evil Lived in Laurel, The White Knights and the Murder of Vernon Dahmer. Now, I'm curious, you've been writing about race for the better part of your long and such a distinguished career, and I'm wondering how you're feeling about the present moment where we find ourselves. Do you feel hopeful? Do you feel despair? I mean, how do you feel, Curtis?
A combination, Susan. What's interesting is when I undertook this project in 2019, we had another guy who was president, and I was not an admirer of Donald Trump. And then there became these efforts to suppress the vote. It's going on now in a number of states, particularly states with large populations of black citizens. And this was at the core of this story, was the Klan was trying to stamp out the voter registration activities of Vernon Dahmer.
Right.
You've got that, and you've got demagoguery and racism, which we certainly still have far too much of in our public life today. If you go back to the 1960s when I was a young reporter, and we compare, say, Mississippi today to what it was, Mississippi is infinitely better than it was in 1960s, but we still have so far to go. And sometimes it's discouraging. So many of the public officials in Mississippi are not committed to progress. In some cases, it seems almost blatant that they're determined to drive blacks out of the state. You know, the state refuses to accept the Medicaid money that's available under the provisions of Obamacare. Give us $2 billion a year, and they refuse to accept it. And there are other things that are going on to, you know, to make it harder to vote in Mississippi. And that's discouraging.
Well, you've borne witness to so many things. I never forget that you were at school with James Meredith, and, you know, you grew up at the University of Mississippi, practically.
Yeah, well, University of Mississippi, you know, that's a place where I think we have really made the progress that's so visible and remain committed to undo all the things that the politicians did to us in the 60s. You know, it was not the school that was telling James Meredith he couldn't come to
control.
It was the governor and his henchmen took over the school in 62. And as a result, Ole Miss was stigmatized for years and been working ever since to undo the damage that the politicians did. I'm very proud of what's happened at Ole Miss.
Well, you've done your bit.
Well, you know, the whole, almost the entire faculty student body is committed to it. It's basically at peace. You know, we've done away with all the Confederate symbols. And I remember long before his death, my friend David Halberstam, who's a wonderful historian and journalist, David felt that Ole Miss was serving as a kind of a national symbol for racial reconciliation. So I'm very proud of that. And that was going on long before I joined the faculty.
Well, we have these places that are crucibles in that struggle, you know, and that was certainly one of them. Well, now that you've retired, I wonder what's next for you. I know you don't play golf.
That's right. That's why I put off retiring for so long. I waited until I was 80, and then I figured, boy, it really is time to retire. So, I'm just trying to be a good father and grandfather. I had the pleasure of teaching three of my grandchildren, including a daughter from Boston, and then, you know, and living in Oxford. I think Oxford's a wonderful town.
It is. It is.
I have no plans to write another book, but I didn't plan to write this one. It kind of came to me.
All right. That gives me a little bit of hope then.
I'll never say never. I enjoy writing.
Well, we sure miss you here in New Orleans.
Well, I miss it too, Susan.
Ah. We've been talking with Curtis Wilkie, whose new book is When Evil Lived in Laurel, The White Knights and the Murder of Vernon Dahmer. Curtis, thank you so much. So good to talk to you.
Thanks, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, Curtis Wilkie discusses his new book, When Evil Lived in Laurel, The White Knights and the Murder of Vernon Dahmer, with writer Jason Berry, Tuesday, July 13th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Stooges Brass Band and Kyle DeCoste celebrate their new book, Can't Be Faded, 20 Years in the New Orleans Brass Band Game, with an appearance Thursday, July 15th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. This is a ticketed event that includes a performance. Gene Fields discusses his new book, Cops and Characters in the Big Easy, True Stories Involving Celebrities, Criminals, and Everyday People, Monday, July 19th at 6, via video conference online sponsored by the Jefferson Parish Library, or see it on the library's Facebook page. One Book, One New Orleans has narrowed down the shortlist for 2022, and readers are invited to vote for their selections by July 25th. The choices are I Am New Orleans, edited by Kalamia Salam, The Big Door Prize by M.O. Walsh, and I Feel to Believe by Jarvis DeBerry. Check out the One Book, One New Orleans Facebook page to vote. And coming up this fall, the New Orleans Book Festival at Tulane University will take place October 21st through 23rd. The event, chaired by historian Walter Isaacson and former New Orleans First Lady Cheryl Landrieu, includes a host of terrific authors, including Teriona Tank Ball, John Barry, Jason Barry, Roy Blunt Jr., Douglas Brinkley, David Brooks, Richard Campanella, James Carville, Jennifer Doudna, Malcolm Gladwell, Eddie Glaude Jr., Annette Gordon-Reed, John Grisham, Mitch Landrieu, Kiese Lehman, Nancy Lemon, Nick Lemon, Michael Lewis, Mary Madeline, General Stanley McChrystal, David Rubenstein, Maurice Carlos Ruffin, Tom Sankton, Joe Scarborough, Katie Simpson-Smith, Michael Tisserand, Kim Vaz-DeVille, and Curtis Wilkie. For more information and the complete lineup, visit bookfest.tulane.edu or follow NOLA Bookfest on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.